Like if someone's not receptive to the message, you're wasting your time. In fact, you're actually probably driving them further away by continuing to push on them.
All right, everybody. Thanks for listening to another episode of the Bitcoin Bottom Line. This is CJ Wilson, and I have a special guest today, the host of Smart People Shit, Dennis Porter, coming to us live from an undisclosed location in the Pacific Northwest. Dennis, how's it going?
What's up, man? Very excited to be on here with you today.
Having you on, I've got my jacket on. We're classing it up a little bit. Let's talk. You got your. I know this is like probably one of your first podcasts from your new setup, your new studio.
Yeah.
I'm going to kind of jump right into it. Lately, you have been very vocal on Twitter Spaces, hosting. Now your podcast is taking off. You have a lot of people. You have your own Telegram group that is very active. I'm constantly getting notifications in there. Tell me a little bit about like what prompted you to just like go full throttle on the boat and just go straight into the Bitcoin lake.
For me, well, I got involved in 2017 in the sense that I, you know, became aware of Bitcoin and wanted to learn more, was just digesting any content that I could get a hold of, which was very limited back then. Nowadays we have too much content to digest. It's impossible. Mastering Bitcoin was the first book I read. Right from there, I just started thinking, what can I do? How can I contribute? But I wasn't really ready to go fully public with who I was and to be a fully public Bitcoiner. And back then it was like, nobody wanted to be a public Bitcoiner. We were all like scared. We were like, somebody's going to come, you know, $5 wrench attack me because they know I have Bitcoin. And so I just kind of took the time to learn. And eventually I decided to start mining. So I started mining for a little bit. Got into that, really enjoyed it, wanted to go all in completely with mining. And the lady was pretty much against that. She told me that if I bought one more mining machine, that she would be kicking me to the curb. She threatens me regularly to kick me to the curb. So it's a healthy relationship. But
I was going to say my wife actually kicked the miners that I had out of the house because she hated that white noise of the fan spinning all the time and the little bling. You know what I mean? Every once in a while.
You know what? The funniest part is she liked the sound. It was crazy. I thought, okay, so we start with like one, you're just kind of like playing with it. Two, three, four, you're rewiring the house. You're putting in all sorts of 220 volt. You know, you're hiring electricians. You're getting better power deals from the electric company, reducing your rate. You're building a box, shoving it out the side of the door, right? To get rid of all the heat because the garage is overheating. And I'm starting to get to that point where the sound is getting wild. And I'm like, there's no way she's going to lose it.
Yeah.
She comes down one time and I was like, the sound doesn't bother you? And she's like, no, I kind of like it actually. It's like a white noise machine. I'm like, I thought it was a match made in heaven for sure. But then all of a sudden she really got upset with how much I was investing in it. I mean, I was fully orange pilled very quickly, right? Like it was all of a sudden realization that, oh my God, this is the most incredible thing that's ever been invented. I need to do anything I can to be getting more of this as fast as possible. And mining was like very hot in 2017 to be a small to medium sized miner. Wanted to go really big, but she was just like, you're literally going insane. You can't do this. This is really rough for me. You're making me feel like unstable basically. So I was like, okay, I'll back it off. And took the next, 2 years, 3 years, just kept learning and understanding Bitcoin. But it wasn't until I would say 2020 and Michael Saylor coming onto the scene that I really started to get FOMO about getting out there and talking about Bitcoin. I had always had, like I said before, that kind of reservation, like, I don't know if I want to be a public Bitcoiner. And then I saw this Michael Saylor guy and I was like, this guy he has a whole life of credibility and money and everything.
And he's putting it all on the line.
Yes. Yeah,
he's a massive target by coming out there and being like, oh, I bought 15,000 Bitcoin or whatever. Yeah. And I think that's what's really interesting is I think people, you go through this arc, right? It's like in Hollywood, you talk about the story arc and you have, you know, it's five acts or three acts or something like that. And the first act is like you get to know somebody. And then the second act is the challenge. Third act is the resolution. I think for Bitcoiners, you get into this sort of like, you know, curiosity accumulation phase, like, and then all of a sudden you get to the finality of like the conviction, right? Like the heavy conviction. That's when you start buying miners and you're like, you know what? I don't have to eat meat for like 3 weeks. I can just eat top ramen and take my meat budget and put it towards miners. And exactly. then And then you get to this plateau where you're like, okay, it's affecting my life so much that it's like, it's hard for me to balance out my real life, you know, with this Bitcoining that I'm doing. And then you sort of like, I think, make the choice to either stay in the shadows or come out of the closet as a Bitcoiner and say, hey, I'm here to like help people and tell you about my journey, you know? And then it's like, hi, CJ. Oh, you're a Bitcoiner. Okay. Let's hear your story. And I think that's a very similar arc that a lot of people go through. And so when we get to the stage that I think you and I are at, where we're sort of out there in the public eye, we're tweeting replies to senators, replies to, you know, congressional appointees and stuff like that about their stances or whatever. There's another phase of the game now, right? Where we're sort of unifying on this plateau and a lot of the people are kind of getting together. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about was just how, you know, like, you and I think both have a parallel vision of this as Bitcoin as a bipartisan unifier, right? So, you know, can you talk a little bit about maybe the background that you've done in politics and what you've, how you see that? Because you have, you know, you're from a different state than I'm from, obviously, and you have different experiences with that. So, you know, help our listeners understand a little bit about your take, and then we can kind of work together on that.
Yeah. So just a little background, for me on politics, I grew up extremely conservative, very religious, lived on the mission field for 3 years, even with my parents, and had a very deep appreciation for the, you know, religious freedom in this country and some of the conservative values. Obviously since then I've left the church, and I would say I'm kind of just agnostic, but, in that time I kind of swung to the left. You know, I thought, you know, well, maybe this is just my parents' teachings and my parents' understanding of the world. Maybe I should go this other direction. And being in Portland, Oregon, so it was where I lived, not so secret. I talk about it quite a bit. It's pretty easy to, you know, meet people that are on the left that think, you know, that that's the way we need to go, that this is the direction that our country should go. And I spent some time over there, but it still didn't quite get what I was looking for. Eventually, I decided to jump into politics. I was really looking at it kind of from a more career type of perspective. Went to go to campaign school, got trained. I believe this was 2017, 2018. And then from there, I ended up working on several campaigns, was a campaign manager. I did 4 primaries where I won 4 out of 4 of the primaries. So I'm hoping with the next one we're working on now with Erica Rhodes will be 5 out of 5. And when I was in politics, I kind of had this understanding that, like, wow, everything is so divisive. It's not just Republicans against Democrats either. It is like, go to the party meetings and you'll quickly realize that the internal party politics are almost more divisive than the, you know, red versus blue. And it really turned me off. And so I walked away from that thinking, you know, I'm done with politics. I'm not interested in this. It's way too chaotic, way too crazy. One thing though, that I did pull out of it during my time there was this idea of single issue voters. And I came about it when I was exposed to this group in Oregon that was fighting to protect the timber industry. Seems like a small issue, but here in Oregon, they are very aggressively anti the timber industry. One of the things they do in Oregon is they weaponize legislation against industries that are predominantly Republican in order to kind of push them out and essentially, you know, destroy the base Republican vote here in Oregon. It's a tactic that's used all over the country, actually, in fact. So it got so bad, though, that they were going to be totally crushed by some of this new legislation. So they got highly active in a very, very short period of time. And they started to dominate the conversation in Oregon. They started to dominate the elections. They started to dominate the conversation around which candidates to choose. And if you weren't in favor of what they were doing, you were like not even a part of the conversation any longer. So one of the things I took away from that, well, 2 things I took away from it. One, I was very extremely jealous and annoyed and irritated that they had so much power, yet they only cared about this one thing. It kind of made me feel like, you know, how dare you only care about this one single issue? How dare you be so, you know, myopic and so focused on this one thing? But inevitably, the reason they had to be so focused on it was because their livelihoods were at stake. Their businesses were at stake. You know, being able to pay for food to put on the table was at stake. And that's the lesson that I pulled out. And that's a lesson that I'm trying to attribute to Bitcoiners now. I think that we can be the most powerful single issue voter bloc in American history. I think that we have the potential to really galvanize a large group of people, because not only do we see Bitcoin as this thing that fixes everything, right? So we're not really single issue voters. We're actually single issue voters that are focused on, you know, the economy, We're single issue voters that are focused on the environment, even. We're single issue voters that are focused on family, that are focused on health. And this gives us an incredible amount of ability to reach a very large group of people, but it also gives us the ability to go extremely deep on this one issue. Like we saw Congress like sat still for several weeks. The most powerful deliberative body in the entire world sat still because of this one amendment, this crypto tax reporting amendment. And we had not been organizing at all. This was our first movement in. And so I really hope that Bitcoiners are able to attach onto this idea of being single issue voters and not being a party unless we have to, because party politics is slow. It's honestly, I sat at a party meeting one time and we debated the meaning of a word for 3 hours. That's what party politics looks like.
Right.
But when you're focused on the movement, like single issue voter, then you can be much more aggressive. And obviously, you know, because you're doing a lot of work yourself, as I would say, considering you a Bitcoin single issue voter, you're out here talking to senators and making things happen. Because why? Because you're defending your business. You're defending your wealth, essentially.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting you say that about the inter-politics being more divisive, because it's the same thing that happens in Bitcoin, where you have this, you know, you have this schism between people that are like, oh, not your keys. And so you should never have it on exchanges. And if you have any Bitcoin on an exchange, then you're out. And it's like, okay. And then you have other people that are like, nah, it's okay. Use Liquid, use Lightning. You know, you can have all these, like, you know, you can have your custodial Bitcoin, you can have trading. And no, you can't trade. And so like even on the pro Bitcoin side, I see this massive spectrum of people that are sort of like, really, they're very unforgiving, you know, and we've seen that with people basically getting ostracized and then people sort of victimizing that ostracization into the labeling, right? To say someone's a shitcoiner, a Bitcoiner, toxic or whatever. And I think it's really interesting because right now we have a chance to actually have conversations with each other, right? And so if you picture the internet 20 years ago, when it was just sort of, you know, the MySpace type of conversations, you could send a message to somebody, maybe instant message. Now you can broadcast live human voice, which you can hear emotions and inflection and all that stuff. And you can have these roundtable discussions on Spaces or Clubhouse or whatever. So how do you feel like sort of the toxicity of like the party politics is related? And is that just sort of normal if you get too many people together on one subject?
Yeah, it's a really great point. I agree with you. There's a very broad spectrum of people in Bitcoin with very diverse opinions on, you know, where Bitcoin needs to go. And that's kind of one of the reasons, just going back to that, that's one of the reasons why I don't want to become a party, because we will sit here and we'll fight over whether you should hold your keys, whether you shouldn't, what's going to, like, parties literally spend, they do these party conventions and they spend hours and hours and hours deciding on the plank that they want to put in there. And then there's this whole debate over whether it'll be this or whether it'll be that. Can you imagine, like, Alex Fetsky and someone like Jeff Booth or Alex Gladstein, like, all trying to debate whether we should, like, decide whether we include the word toxicity in, like, the plank? I mean, it would be like your face would melt off listening to that. I mean, it'd be a great conversation. I'd love to hear it, but it would be a waste of time, waste of time. We can do that on Spaces all day long. That's why I like this idea of the single issue voter, because we don't need to worry about all that. We just move forward. If we need to make a party in the future, fine, let's do it. I have no issue with that. But yeah,
but there's so much to be done. There's so much to be done before that's necessary. I think, and that's the way I look at it. I think people that want to get into the minutia, and like I said, everyone's at a different space in their arc, right? Everyone's at a different speed or a different RPM or whatever you want to call it. Some people are out there buying miners, mining at home. Some people are out there building a mining company. Some people are building their own app or their own website or, you know, podcasting or whatever. Some people are just listening for the first time and they're like, I have $100. What do I do? You know? And I think there's this like broad spectrum of like where everybody comes in, and you have to have a bucket, you know what I mean, that people can land in and like just sort of get up to speed, right? And the get up to speed bucket is not necessarily the Alan Farrington or the Svetsky or those guys that are very drilled down into minute levels of like details. And I was listening to Svetsky talk today, earlier today, about, you know, just like democracy and like types of governments and stuff like that. I'm like, man, we are so far away from like what a beginner needs to be hearing in this particular conversation. It's almost like you need to have like a sort of, like a pilot's rating. You know what I mean? Where it's like, until you've completed these things, maybe it's the Sailor Academy, until you've completed these things, don't worry about this upper level stuff, because it's like trying to juggle while you're running, you know, and while you're like playing the harmonica. Like, there's only so many things you need to ask people to do when they're first getting into it. And I think that's where, like, it's interesting, because I feel like Bitcoin is like a massive incentive to have a continual learning path. And, of you course. Know, you and I both have discussed that before. Like, so for you right now, you're out there learning more about Bitcoin as you go, right? We've both been in it about the same period of time. I feel like there's so much content. Where do you go? Like, what helps you, I guess, just make that progress, so you keep getting not necessarily deeper into it, but just more well-rounded or more skilled or whatever you want to call it.
The funny part about where we are with content creation is, fortunately, I don't have to choose anyone in particular. There's a lot of incredible writers out there. You brought up Alan Farrington. You also have Tomer Strohlite, who does some incredible short pieces.
Awesome.
And I think this is the wild part, is we don't need to go to one place to find it. But if I'm going to listen to a podcast, I mean, it really comes down to the quality of the show, the quality of the guests, the quality of the conversation. And it's really hard to beat guys like Peter McCormick, man. I mean, he brings on some of the best people, and he's just a great interviewer. And some people don't like him, and that's that. But he does an incredible job with that show. I listen to it not just to gain information, but also for formatting and for understanding how to run a good show and have a good podcast. Obviously, I've always listened to Marty Bent and Odell with the Tales from the Crypt. They do an incredible job of keeping it of a more, like you say, almost like that maximalist, very pure message that is needed sometimes when you're in this space and you are Bitcoin only, like myself. So I go to several different places, but I try to stick to people that consistently want to bring high quality content to the space, because I don't have to worry. Like, when I listen to the show, like, yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there that's entertainment and other, but it's like, for me personally, I have very little time to digest content, because I have two shows that I'm running now. So I have the Smart People Shit, and underneath that, I also have the Update. So it's constant, constant, constant. And when I want to digest content, I got to make sure that I'm maximizing my time. So I'm either going to the best writers or the best podcast creators out there.
So how do you juggle the content creation and prepping to create content versus digesting the content? You know, like, I have a full-time job, so I'm kind of like trying to read articles on the side. I've got TweetDeck up or something like that. I'm listening to spaces or podcasts, especially, I mean, for me, the only time that I really have is when I'm like walking the dog or pushing the stroller around the neighborhood, where I can have headphones in and no one's disturbing me, where I can get a good 45 minutes of just like absorption. You know, do you have like a Zen thing like that, where you have a budget for a certain amount of time per day, or how do you manage that?
Yeah. So I have a pretty bad ADHD, so it's hard for me to just listen to something and not do something else. So I found that one of the best ways for me is to do the dishes, listen to a podcast, sweep the floors, do laundry, anything that's kind of like easy to do in the background with your hands. And then also listen and take in the content. And typically I pair that up. So maybe this is giving away too many secrets. I'm sure many podcasters probably already do this kind of thing. But typically what I do is I get good guests. You know, I always want to have good guests. When I'm researching for that guest, I'm listening to podcasts, I'm reading articles from them as I'm doing other things. And then I'm writing down notes from those episodes of things I might want to ask that person. So it's kind of like a 3-for-1. I'm getting something done. I'm researching for a guest, and I'm learning, and I'm prepping, and I'm coming up with questions. So I try to get it all to be as efficient as possible when I'm digesting content, because I don't have time for random, like, that's the thing, is like some of this stuff that Alan Farrington puts out, like, I don't even have time to digest it. It's like, I almost need to invite him on the show just so I can fit him in, because I have to do my research as well. Cause I always want to put out good stuff, good content. But that's the thing, is the quality of the content. It's just going through the roof right now. It's absolutely tearing away. And so if you're not willing to put in the time and energy into researching your guest and to making sure you deliver super valuable content to the space, there's so much out there. People are not going to waste the time to, I wouldn't say waste the time, they're not going to take the time to listen to your stuff if you don't put the effort in.
Yeah. So it's a massive, Bitcoin has become a massive magnet. It's drawing in all these extremely intelligent people. It's created these sort of these cycles, you know, these beacon cycles of, or signals where you have Saifedean or, you know, Marty or Alan or whoever putting out these pieces of content, Jimmy Song, stuff like that. And they're blasting these things out. And because their messaging is so like consistent or, you know, like topical, right? You know, like when you're going to a certain restaurant, you get the lasagna, you know, another restaurant, you're getting the fish, right? And you know, if you need, I think as you get into your own plateau as a Bitcoiner, sometimes you get a feel that, hey, I need to listen to Marty and Matt talk about, you know, sort of self-sovereignty and taking control of things and how ESG is a scam. And then other times you're like, hey, I want to listen to Jimmy Song, like really plain text, the technology that's happening right now and in his tech talk updates or something like that. So that's kind of what I do. I have a sort of budget. Like I have an hour or two a day where I can try to mix in some listening content. And I try to rotate through some of these guys, and it's, you know, Safe's podcast, Marty, Peter, you know, some of these people, yourself. But to me, I think one of the most interesting things about the entire Bitcoin content space is the people that still remain relatively anonymous, like Plan B or
GG.
And I think it's fascinating because those guys specifically, right, they're able to keep a distance. And I think part of that distance that they're able to keep allows them to depersonalize part of their opinion to be purely logical. And when I read Tomer's stuff or Gigi's stuff, I find it so much more therapeutic than some of the other stuff that I get from other people, which is much more browbeating. You know, they're trying to smack you over the head with a topic or, you know, something like that. And so I need, by the time Thursday rolls around, I need a piece of Tomer's sort of like brevity. I need his, you know, I need something that's a little bit short and sweet. That's more poetic, you know, if that makes sense. And I think that aspect of it, there's not really like a ranking format yet, but I'm almost interested in creating like a sort of tournament of champions to for different categories, you know, depending on what you need, like a menu, funneling people. Cause it's like, hey, you need to get slapped around a little bit. Here's a Svetsky piece, you know, yeah. What I mean? Something like that, you know, but yeah. I think, but it's interesting.
Svetsky because will definitely slap you around. That's for sure.
100%. And I think, you know, the clubhouse and the Twitter spaces and stuff like that, we're seeing this sort of equilibrium there where people are enjoying participating in this large scale format. But then it's like, if you're hosting spaces the right way, what you're doing is you're creating impetus for someone to dive deeper afterwards with a single piece, right? And I think that's where it might be kind of cool to do some spaces where we're basically hosting like a Cliff's Notes or a book review or something like that, and then encouraging people to go do their own research with that subject later. You know, what do you think about that type of stuff?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's interesting that you say that, because we are actively looking with Swan Bitcoin. For those of you that don't know, I work closely with Swan Bitcoin and Corey over there. I think they're an incredible company. And if you're looking for a place, you know, they sponsor my show, but I'm a customer, incredible exchange led by great Bitcoiners. But we're trying to work on a space like that right now where we, you know, break it up into segments and we give people the ability to, you know, digest the content in a different way. So yeah, I'm always down for unique types of spaces. This is a really interesting time because to some degree we have reinvented live radio. And I think that we're just at the very beginning of what's possible with this type of new medium. And I really look forward to what people are going to come up with. I've had some incredible spaces myself. I've done debates, a couple of debates, one with Udi, one with David Hoffman from Bankless. Also, I look like I'm going to be doing, I'm going to be doing one here in a second with British as well. So I really like the idea of kind of using it as a way to do, you know, you can plan the content out, like how I did with the Bipartisan Bitcoin Room, which you were a part of. We had Caitlin Long, we had Jeff Booth, we had Alex Gladstein, Bradley Rettler,
Erica,
Preston Pish, Erica dropped by, Ian Caldrone, who is from a former California legislator, as well as Matthew Diemer. I mean, it's like, right, like there's like all this preparation and effort that goes into it. But then sometimes it's, you know, that's you get 1,000 people in a room, but then it's like, on the other hand, you had me and Udi debating over nothing. And we had, you know, basically the core of Bitcoin and what it even means, which is, you know, a pointless debate to some degree. And you had 2,500 people in the room. And then you have other rooms where it's just spawn of the moment, just like, hey, breaking news, right?
Yeah.
So it's really interesting to see how people will use them. And I look forward to diving deeper on trying to figure out new ways to use it and really get people into the room. Because ultimately, all of us, what is our goal? We're trying to get people to buy Bitcoin. We We believe Bitcoin is the future. We're Bitcoin only, and we want to make sure we can do anything to get in people's ears, to get them to, you know, buy this incredible technology that'll help them save their time and energy into the future.
Yeah, I think the bullishness is constantly accelerated, right, by this highbrow intellectual conversation. It's very stimulating to have people debating, right? And now that they have the tips feature on Twitter, I think the next interesting thing will be a sort of live scoreboard of people voting. Because if you can tip, you can vote, right? That. And so one of the things I posted out there after the tip thing was, hey, it's great that we can tip, but if we can vote through Twitter, right, live, then you can really score the debate and you can have a moderator really go through and say, okay, let's look at the scoreboard here. And you have Dennis got 10 points or 800 votes and Udi got 700 votes or whatever it was. And, you know, you can have a very objective result from that. And I think that would be very valuable for us in the Bitcoin community, because we constantly, I think we're our own best critics, right? And it's like, I read from some people, whether it's Parker or Jimmy, and they're like, Bitcoin doesn't really have very, very many smart critics. The best critics of Bitcoin are inside Bitcoin.
Yes.
The outsiders that are trying to constantly attack Bitcoin, they're actually like, it's like that DeSantis Florida ad where they try to make him look terrible. And everyone's like, I actually think Florida's kind of okay. I think when people have bad arguments against Bitcoin, all it does is make Bitcoin easier to sell to people that are smart and understand it, you know? And I think if we can get like a debate program, you know, if they can do a debate API, that would be hot. I'd be super into that. Not that I'm trying to go out there and 8 Mile debate everybody, but I would definitely, I'd be interested in moderating.
Try it out, man. It's a thrill. Yeah. I think debating is, it's something that I've always liked to do, but I've never done it in a public format. In fact, that debate with David Hoffman was the very first public debate I've ever done in my entire life. I was never on a debate team. I never did anything like that. I never debated people openly. And then the Udi debate was the second debate I've ever done in my lifetime. But it was a thrill to prepare for those, because you feel like you know, you're like driving towards the cliff and you have to try to prepare for the jump off the cliff. And if you don't prep your parachute correctly, you know, you're going to fall straight into the ground immediately. Or maybe you got a little parachute on and you want to fly down a little bit and glide for a little while before you pull the chute. But yeah, it's a death defying kind of experience, because you're right in front of everybody who is going to openly judge every single word you say, which will never be good enough for the Bitcoin community, right? It's like, I think every single time I hear a debate, it's like the end result is, they didn't quite represent Bitcoin good enough. We should have got a whole team of people up there debating. Well, you know, if you get a whole team up there debating one person, it's not really a debate and nobody's right. Going to listen to that. So
yeah, that's just like a band. Everybody wants to be the lead guitarist or the lead singer. And, you know, I think Bitcoin doesn't necessarily function that way, right? It doesn't necessarily function in that same format where you can have five people kind of going as a battle of the bands and you do like a Family Feud style, you know, debate or
I've seen them. They don't get very many viewers when people try to run them that way. That's for sure. And it's not because they are not doing a great job. It's just, there's something about the one-on-one. It's like a battle to the death. I mean, it's like very like poetic. It's very like Colosseum, you know, to have these gladiators like going at it and there's no one there to save them. So
yeah, it's high stakes. It's very high stakes.
It's extremely high stakes and not very many people can do it. I still get terrified when I do it. It's very much like real life gladiator shit. Like, so I had a really great time with the David Hoffman one. I feel like I consensus by the internet was that I won that. Although I think they gave me a little too much credit, but it comes down to those kind of like gotcha moments. And I got the gotcha moment in the Hoffman one, right? Which is the video that exploded about him saying that, you know, fiat is tinkerable. And I was like, well, so is Ethereum. And the video. Well, then Udi got the other one, right? Cause I missed that tweet. And then now he found it and posted it up at the top. So that was the gotcha moment there. And everything else in the debate didn't matter. No one cared what was said in the content of the debate. It was pointless, right? And that's the same thing with these presidential debates, right? You could go the whole time losing. But at the very end, if you get a gotcha moment, you won the whole debate. It's like the death blow, right? It's like, you're like a UFC fighter and you're bloodied up and you're beat up, but like the very last moment, the buzzer beater, you knock the guy out, right? That's just the way these debates are. And it's a thrill and it's a fun. And I hope to do them again in the future, but taking a small reprieve, because those two were really close back to back. And it was hard to do any content because of how close they were together.
Well, and then I guess the thing is, do you sort of run out of things to debate about, right? Or do you have to pick? Because I think it's very easy to say that, like, once you become a Bitcoiner, it's sort of a one-way street, right? You don't really, you're not like suddenly going to sell your Bitcoin and just go another direction and just like, you know what, I'm going to be a sandwich maximalist. I'm just going to sell sandwiches. And, you know, I'm big on pepperoncinis. And like, that's what I'm going to do the rest of my life is be a sandwich artist. You know, I think people that get to a certain level of Bitcoin, you realize that you'll probably never have as much as you would like to have, because I think everybody wants to have that safety and financial security of saying, okay, I've got this big pile of money I can sort of like sit on or whatever. But I think for me, I think of it in a way of, you know, how many people are we connecting to the Bitcoin network? And then the challenge of not necessarily debating people, but sort of inviting them and bringing them into the fold, right? Because if we see Bitcoin as like an arc, what are we doing with the no coiners? You know, and how do we make sure that we're not leaving them behind too early before they actually have time to get up to speed, right? Because it's like you see those movies where the train's going or the truck is driving and you have the guy running to try to get on, you know? I think Bitcoin in a lot of ways is like that. And we're like, come on, jump in the Bitcoin train, come on, you know? And people are like throwing their knapsack in there and they're like, you know, reaching up and then they get like pulled up or whatever. So, you know, how long do we work on an individual person or a group of people before we have to sort of like say, hey, listen, the train's going to leave the station and we can't just not waste our time, but like, we're going to give you so many chances to try to get on board. And if you don't, then we're going to move on to the next town. So how does that affect you with your sort of either your personal life with your family and friends or through these spaces and through the groups and Telegram and podcasting and stuff?
You know, it's very much like religion in a sense, where if someone is not receptive, because this is something we talked about a lot when I was in the church, it's like if someone's not receptive to the message, you're wasting your time. In fact, mm-hmm. you're actually probably driving them further away by continuing to push on them, because you're creating a situation where they now have to defend their position. And then now you're going to have to defend their ego. So if your intention is to some degree to push them away, yeah, like go ahead, keep going after them until they're red in the blue in the face and they don't want to be your friend anymore. Ultimately, I think it's more important to maintain relationships. So if it's some random person on the internet, like who gives a shit, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like they're going to have to do whatever they do, or as, you know, Udi originated that saying, you know, have fun staying poor, right? I don't like to use it too often because it's not really my approach, but you take the time that you can. If someone is curious and wants to know and is interested in learning about Bitcoin, you talk to them as long as they want to talk. The moment they start to not be a good faith actor, or they are not really trying to ask good questions and they're really there to just try to debate, well, you can continue to debate them. But if your intention is not to debate, but your intention is to actually orange pill them, well, then you need to move on, or you need to give them a break, you know, like lay off for a second. So I've had that happen with friends and family. I'm aggressive. I'm really trying to push them to buy Bitcoin, to get into Bitcoin, but ultimately they become resistant. And so I'm like, okay, time to stop, time to move on to someone else who is really interested in hearing the message of Bitcoin, because our time is valuable and there are other people out there who are more than happy to hear the message. That's why I really like Spaces. That's why I really like Clubhouse, because you have a whole room, you have a whole space or club of people that are ready to learn, that are ready to ask questions. And I think Clubhouse and Spaces in particular has really, really sped up the timetable on a lot of people's orange pill path. So yeah, if you want to debate, but if your goal is to orange pill, the moment someone becomes resistant, you really should probably take a step back and move on to the next person.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, I think there's a certain time allocation where it's not necessarily that you've completed the mission, but you can see that there's actually progress in the mission. You know, it's like you keep watering the tree if it's continuing to grow, but the second that the tree turns on you, then you're like, okay, you know what? This isn't for us. Maybe I'm the wrong messenger. Maybe you're the wrong recipient at this point, and I need to kind of water the next tree.
And that's a really good point, because I have had friends who, or even people online, right, that I'm debating, talking to, and then someone else comes in and they speak their language. Like, for instance, Mike Alfred, this happened with him. I was talking to this guy back and forth, debating back and forth constantly about Bitcoin. But the person I was debating was one of those traditional finance equity type of people. That's not my language, right? I never went to college, one quarter and I quit. And then I never got into traditional finance or equity stuff. I've never been a CEO. So I don't really speak the language of, you know, the C-suite types or the people that are, you know, used to talking about, I don't know, like what's one of the things that they always say? Like, they're I don't even know because I don't spend any time in that world. But Mike Alfred jumped in to this room, and it was one of the first times I'd ever spoken with him. And immediately this guy who comes from that universe, like, melted like putty in Mike's hands and was just like, oh, I get it. So sometimes it's not always down. Don't get hard on yourself if you can't convince someone. It's not always about your level of knowledge, which is important, but it's also about your ability to deliver a message in a language that they understand. So, you know, bring a friend in, tag a friend in that comes from their world. And I guarantee you, you'll probably make a lot of ground with that type of person.
Yeah, I think the empathy really works for a lot of people. And I think you have to understand what people's hot button issues are. I think for me locally, a lot of the farmers and stuff that are here in Fresno, they're seeing it as a hard money situation, right? Because they have tangible assets. They have a farm, they have water, they have plants, they have trees, they have fruit, they have nuts. These are the things that they see this cycle, right? They put in work. They're totally okay with putting in work. They get their hands dirty. They're okay with that. They want something they can hold. And the tangibility of Bitcoin is hard for them to really grasp. And then all of a sudden you're like, hey, here's the wallet. And they're like, oh, wait, I can touch it. And you're like, yeah, you plug it into your computer. And then there you go. And I think figuring out how to deliver those empathetic messages to people to say in a non-condescending way, because it's like part in the back of your head, I think as a Bitcoiner is have fun staying poor. It's always in there, right? If someone's going to try to debate you, or if they're going to be like, oh, I put all this money into Polkadot and the chain split and blah, 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 or Solana or whatever. And then you see some of these people that are like, oh, crypto is trash and I don't believe in it. And you're like, okay, that's a have fun staying poor person. Like, I'm just going to cut it off there. Because if someone's unwilling to engage in the conversation at all because they think it's evil or something like that, that's a much harder thing to grasp. But if someone is an investor and they're interested in some sort of like, you know, hedge, or they're worried about inflation, then I think that's where that for me personally, I think if someone ever brings up inflation, I'm like, well, let me tell you about Bitcoin. And it's kind of funny, but
the hard supply cap makes a lot of sense to people these days, ever since we started printing to infinity. And ever since the Fed and the chairman and all these guys are coming out and being like, well, we just push a button, we print money. People are like, wait, what? You can do that? And now all my friends is like, oh, it has a hard supply cap. You can only have 21 million ever. And bing, all of a sudden it makes sense now that, like, I've been telling you this for, you know, years, and now all of a sudden you get it because they are actually printing the money we told you they're going to print. It's very funny to watch.
Yeah. But I mean, for me though, I can say this from personal experience. Like, I didn't offhand love Bitcoin right away. I had to like really take my time with it because I didn't trust a lot of the aspects of it. Because when I first heard about it, it was through the Mt. Gox thing or through the Silk Road. And that was obviously negative stuff that was getting put out there. But now, obviously, I realized, okay, that some of that was just bad marketing from people that were anti-Bitcoin, realistically, right? And so, you know, learning how to filter that out as a grown-up has been pretty interesting. But it also allows me to be empathetic of that journey, to know that it doesn't take 2 weeks to get it for some people. It takes a lot longer. And the good thing about me being out there publicly as a public person that's a Bitcoiner is I think it has people seeking me out because they're like, hey, you tweet about this all the time. Like, can you tell me about something? You know, I'm like, yeah, sure. Let's go to lunch. Let's talk about it. And I think that is a cool process when you know that like someone bought in at 30 and now it's at 50, someone bought in at 18 and it's a 45 or whatever. And they're like, hey, thanks, man. I'm up. I'm super up. I appreciate it. And it's like, hey, it's not going to be up forever. It's going to go sideways or down a little bit. It's going to be volatile. But, you know, that's part of the ride. And we're all in this together. And the more of us that are doing it realistically, then the more of a true network we have where we can actually interact completely on the Bitcoin network, where we're buying things with Satoshis, you know, like Bitcoin Beach and things like that. And, you know, soon there will be 3 countries, 5 countries, 10 countries where it's legal tender, because that's the trend of everything, right? There's the first, remember video phones, like from the movie Total Recall, that was like a thing. And then it took like so many years for like video phones or Zoom to actually be a real thing, because it had to become effectively like a software layer, not just a hardware product, you know? And I think that's where we're going with Bitcoin. So in 4 or 5 years, it'll be hilarious to think back to 2018 and think about where it was in 2018 and where it is in 2028, you know, and how many things have changed in the world as a result of the world becoming more parallel. So,
well, yeah, and people don't realize, I mean, think about history, like how far we've come in such a short period of time. You didn't have an iPhone before 2008, 2009. Like, you didn't have a smartphone like 10 years ago. And now you can't live without them. It's incredible how quickly technology, in the sense that, like, you know, we have technology is a broad word, but we're talking about, I would say, like the technology that we understand today, like computers, smartphones, has advanced so rapidly that this, you know, DSLR camera is an app on my phone, which is incredible, right? And I think they're going to have the same thing is going to occur with banking. The bank used to be a bank. Like, you have to go to the bank, you have to deposit money, and they would secure the money for you. That's now an app on your phone.
Right.
We had a technological deflationary period that put everything on your phone. And now when it comes to everything, calculator, right? You got your phone, you got your map, you got everything on there. You're gonna have the same thing happen with finance. You're gonna have an absolute deflationary period when it comes to what you use on a day-to-day basis to track your finances, to store your wealth. It's gonna be an app on your phone. It's gonna be Strike. Strike, you can do remittances and you can buy Bitcoin already. Well, right. They're going to add loans. They're going to add payday. They're going to add it all. It's going to be one freaking app on your phone. And I think it's going to change a lot of things. And it's just the beginning. And that's just the one thing is changing the finances, right? But once you change the finance, and I know you know this, and a lot of other Bitcoiners know this out there, but once you change the financial layer, the base layer of society, which is what society is built on, you can't have society without money. I talked about this with Gigi just a second ago and when we had a conversation. And once you change that, when you get away from corrupt money and you go to pure money, it's like such a difference. You're going to see things change quite rapidly. You're going to see people change. You're going to see behavior change. And society is going to get tighter and closer and better. And we're going to cooperate on a level that we've never seen before in, I think, human society. So the last time it happened, I would say, would probably be during the last Renaissance. So I'm a big, big believer that this is ultimately going to lead to a second Renaissance where we're going to see human beings go from, you know, Alex Svetsy talks about this. They go from Homo erectus or whatever to Homo sapiens from fire, because we were able to digest, you know, use nutrients better, more efficiently. And then once we move from corrupt fiat money to Bitcoin, we're going to evolve to another state. And I really do believe that. And so I really look forward to being on the other side with you of hyper Bitcoinization and seeing what the world is going to look like. I think it's coming much sooner than people realize.
Oh yeah. Well, it's already happening because you're seeing the hyperinflation. And when people say, oh, hyperinflation is like Zimbabwe. Well, maybe not necessarily, because the market cap of all the assets that's inflating is so big, you know, that it's impossible to have the entire American economy have everything double in price, but some things will double in price, right? Some things will go up 30% because there's just not enough absorption capability for like home prices to triple in a short period of time. But there is absorption capability because of the loan process and fractional lending for home prices to go up 30%, which they have in a lot of places.
Bitcoin is hyper Bitcoin is hyperinflating right now in front of us.
Right. And I think that's a result of the money that's gone injected into the system. Right. So when in a way, it's almost like the $1 trillion coin that they're talking about would have less of an effect because it's not actually being distributed, you know? So when they distribute this money and it goes to all these people, whether it's through loans or whatever, I think my prediction, and I'm just as passionate as you are about this, but I think you're very expressive about it. And that's why I wanted to have you on, because I think like we're both on that same parallel. It's going to benefit so many people when the quality of goods goes up, because then you're going to have less goods getting discarded into landfills, right? You're going to have less, people are going to think harder before they buy something because they're going to want better stuff that's going to last them longer, because those hard-earned Satoshis that they had to work their ass off to earn, those are going to be so valuable that they're going to make better decisions on balance with their lives. And I think that opportunity cost is something that a lot of people don't understand because they're in that fiat mindset. And I think Bitcoin gets you out of that completely and gets you into a real opportunity cost zone where you say, I can have this or this, but I can't have both. Whereas like, you know, the sort of shop till you drop, keep swiping is I'll have both. I'll return the one I don't like. That to me is one of the most like toxic things about society is the way we're marketed to and shopped for, is that it's like, oh, you can just have everything you want right now and you'll pay for it later. Well, it's like, yeah, but you're not just paying for it later. You're also missing out on all these other things in the meantime. And later, that pain is going to be 8 to 20 times what it is today with that interest rate you're paying, because you're thinking about the opportunity cost that you missed out by not buying Bitcoin. I'm sort of like running out of time and I don't want to take up too much of your time, but if you have a final thought, I'd love to hear it on just general gleeful bullishness. It's Q4. You know, typically this is where we see this elasticity come in. I don't want to talk about price, but I want to talk about adoption. How many more Bitcoiners do you think we're going to get in this next 3 to 6 month phase as Bitcoin remains bullish broadly?
Yeah, real quick to touch on the consumerism, I think that you're right. It's definitely something that's going to go away. There's a reason why our grandparents used to say they don't make things like they used to. It's because they literally don't make things like they used to. When they were on a gold standard, they made things high quality because to get the pennies, which my grandfather would go around and switch the damn lights off for because he was so sold on this idea that the money he was holding was so valuable that he didn't want to give away a single penny to the electrical company. But they're going to start making goods in better and better quality to start to get you to give up your Bitcoin. You're not going to want to give up your Bitcoin for crap, right? So everybody's going to be on Bitcoin. All the quality is going to go through the damn roof. It's going to be an incredible experience to watch that happen, to finally get a car that doesn't break down every 5 years, to get a phone that doesn't become obsolete within, you know, a couple of years as well. The battery dies automatically. It's planned obsolescence is a thing that's going away. So Q4 adoption, I think that the all-time high, I think when we hit a new all-time high, which I firmly believe we will, because the Fed is going to continue to print, they're going to continue to make sure this market doesn't collapse. They're pretty much stuck into a corner. And I think the price is going to go up to the all-time high. And once it gets there, that's when retail is going to come in and it's going to absolutely explode. I don't think we even should have dipped down. I think it was all due to the mining move and a few other factors that have been in play in the over-leveraged market. And that market exploded and we dropped down to where we are today. If you take that away, you take that anomaly away, I think we're still simmering up at all-time highs. And then the market would have come back in. So now, because of the fact that we've dropped down and we're going back, it's almost like a giant bear trap, right? We're going to go back up. We're going to hit that. Retail is going to come in. They're going to drive it even further. And that's when the real FOMO is going to take off. I know you don't want to talk about price, but price, NGU, is the driving factor in adoption. And that's a lot of what got me in 2017. You know, I was in 2017, but as soon as it started going up, I was like, I lost my mind. I was like, oh my God, this is it. We're going hyper Bitcoinization right now. And every new entrant thinks that. So there's a lot of new entrants that are kind of just here, just getting their first sats, or there's industrial or institutional people that are just starting to be able to buy, and they don't want this thing to slip away from them. So I think you're going to see a lot of adoption happen really fast. You're going to see a huge amount of FOMO, especially if we get across all-time highs. And it's price, you know, who knows where it'll go. It really doesn't matter. It's kind of irrelevant. But I think we're going to probably see 2 to 3, 4 times the current all-time high that we're at right now, at a minimum. Some people say 100K is it, but I think that's a pretty bearish number at this point.
Yeah, I just think it depends on how many people start pulling their Bitcoin off exchanges, right? I think that's the number one factor, because if there's less Bitcoin on exchanges, less Bitcoin available, then there's less of it that needs to be purchased at higher prices to move the market. Because if people have their if they're DCAing and they're just buying their $20 or $10 or whatever it is at a time, just kind of keep chomping it down, whether that's through Strike or Swan or any of these other services that are awesome that I use, then I think it comes down to like, all right, how much Bitcoin needs to be bought? You know, $1 billion worth, $10 billion worth, $100 billion worth, like where does it shoot the price up where it maybe doubles in market cap or something? And I think that's where there's been a lot of people that have tried to use mathematical formulas, not saying plan B, but I'm saying people say, oh, if this much money comes in, it actually moves the market this much more. I think that's what's fascinating about Glassnode is to see on chain how much Bitcoin is long-term hold, right? And how old some people's coins are, because I think, and then that, and also what's the percentage of coins in profit, right? Meaning that like people have bought it below where they're at now. And, you know, it's fascinating. And I think we could probably go on for 2 hours just debating, you know, the instigators for that. But I think going back to tying it all in, Bitcoin as a single issue, as a single thing, it gets so much attention because it has so many different angles on it. It really is a 360 and three-dimensional kind of sphere that has this dramatic gravitational pull where you get so much focus, so much futuristic idea, so much, you know, like you said, FOMO or emotional empathy towards it, because it's so much better than all these other things that we've tried to invest in before, because it's durable, visible, transparent. We know how much there is, right? And I think, and you can also say how much is like being traded, you know, and you can see how much is moving, and you can watch the block explorer and see how much is being sent back and forth. So I think it's awesome. And I'm obviously very bullish on Bitcoin. So Dennis,
yeah,
thank you so much for
of course
joining me and I will see you on Spaces soon, I'm sure.
But, yeah. If people want to find me, they can find me over on Twitter. I'm pretty active over there. Dennis_Porter_, but if you just search Dennis Porter, you'll find me. I'm top search there. There's not very many Dennis Porters in the world, apparently. Also, you know, I have my show, Smart People Shit. I've had you on there as well, and look forward to having you on in the future, but also my new show that I talked about, The Update, that's going to be coming on. Yeah, dude, thank you so much for having me be a part of this. I really love what you're doing in the space. I'd love to, you know, go a deep dive on politics with you again here soon, because you're doing so much work, and it really, you don't get enough credit for it, but I think in the future, I know credit's not important, but I think you're really going to become someone that's a big name and a big person in this space in the political realm, just because you're just grinding it out under the radar. Can't wait for more of this stuff to come out.
I'm just a humble business owner that really likes the orange coin. So
yeah, exactly. Yeah, aren't we all?
Yeah. But thanks, Dennis. Thanks for coming on the Bitcoin Bottom Line. And this has been a fantastic episode talking to Dennis, who has really taken his self-sovereign media journey by the horns and is driving force towards, you know, Bitcoin adoption. Dennis is sponsored by Swan Bitcoin, and I think that's a great thing. They're out there promoting a lot of content. Corey and the gang are putting together some fantastic YouTube videos and things like that. So we'll be sharing some of those resources as well, especially towards the energy FUD and stuff such as this machine greens. So anyways, Dennis, I'm signing off, and I will see you soon. And thank you so much for joining me on the Bitcoin Bottom Line.
See you, buddy.
So once again, thank you for listening to the Bitcoin Bottom Line with Stephen McClurg and CJ Wilson. The opinions presented herein are solely of the individual and are not necessarily representative of Valkyrie Investments, Inc. and their affiliates. There is no guarantee that any specific outcome will be achieved. Investments may be speculative, illiquid, and there is a risk of total loss of your investment. Past performance is not indicative of future.